Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does the actual life of one of the busiest actors in Hollywood compare with our visions of glamour and luxury? Since Stephen Tobolowsky moved to Southern California in 1976, he has played more than 200 characters in major feature films, independent productions, and network and cable TV, from a terrifying white supremacist in Mississippi Burning to the cluelessly annoying Ned Ryerson in Groundhog Day to the corrupt Hugo Jerry in the critically acclaimed HBO Western Deadwood. But Tobolowsky's new memoir is less a tell-all about the huge productions and vast list of A-listers he's worked with than a personal tale of the artist who grew up in Oak Cliff, studied drama at SMU, and has spent decades reflecting on his development as an artist, a professional, and a person. The new book is called The Dangerous Animals Club. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. Good to be here.
You have this story in the book about this conversation you had with Harold Ramis on the set of Groundhog Day, and he said, it's so impossible to make it in this business. Everybody who does needs at least four heroes. We will talk about some of yours, but I'm curious about what making it means and if that definition has changed for you over the years.
Wow. Yes and yes. No one has ever asked that question. Boy. This is a question that all young actors should listen to, because they always have different ideas of making it. When I was very young, maybe 10 years old, well, before that, I thought making it meant you would hang out with monsters. I loved monsters, and I thought if you were a professional actor that Wolfman and Dracula, Godzilla, they were real, and you could hang out with them. As I matured, I thought making it meant you won awards. And I remember practicing Academy Award speeches in the shower. Mm-hmm. I remember one in particular. It was right after Charlton Heston won for the Ten Commandments. In the shower, I was imagining that I was beating out Gary Cooper. I had actually been nominated in my head for two films that year. One of them was The Torah, which I said, it's better than the Ten Commandments. It's longer and it's got a lot more laws. So then later, I thought in college, I thought making it was being able to ply your craft as an artist because acting was noble. And I wonder, why on earth did I get that idea? And I think because I was touched by Shakespeare. It was my first real exposure to the genius of Shakespeare. I mean, we all are exposed to Shakespeare in junior high and high school, Julius Caesar at the Dallas Theater Center or something like that. But when you really understand the depth and breadth of what that man brought to our lives, it takes your breath away. And I think I was touched by him in a way, a personal way, that I thought acting was kind of noble. And then I headed out to Los Angeles, in which I thought making it meant just getting a job, just getting an audition was successful. At the beginning, you think I'm going to go out there and count my successes. But then you think, next, I'm going to count my near misses. They count too. And then you're grateful just for your failures. I remember I had in Los Angeles taped onto my refrigerator, I think it was Eugene O'Neill, is may I have the courage to press on to greater failures. And I think I certainly have in my life. I pressed on to all sorts of failures.
You write about when you started realizing you were losing your hair, and you've done very well throughout your career without it. But I get that that shifted for you when you were in your early 20s, the sorts of roles that would be available to you. Can you talk about that?
Oh, it was heartbreaking. I always, when you're a young person, you don't imagine you're going to play bank teller. You imagine you're going to play Hamlet, and Hamlet has hair, and all of these leading characters, Romeo has hair. You imagine you're going to be a romantic lead, and I was in graduate school, and suddenly one day in the shower, and I think it was from overuse of streaks and tips from playing an old man.
Oh, right, because you had to have gray hair.
I had to have gray hair. And so they miss, again, bottle abuse with streaks and tips. 1 week of streaks and tips straight, I was in the shower, and it came out in handfuls. And first of all, your heart starts beating very hard, like you do when you're in an accident, mm-hmm. and you wonder, you try to assess the damage. But this damage went beyond a broken arm or a broken finger. It went into my psyche, and I thought, I will never look like a young person again. And every subsequent audition I had after that, I would come in, I would see a casting director, someone across, and I see the eyes go up to my hairline and my vanishing hairline, thinking like, well, he could be a bank manager. He could play, you know, he could play draft dodger, but he isn't going to play the lead in our show. So in a way, I had to reconfigure the dream. This may be another key to success in show business, is the ability to reconfigure the dream. Does the dream break you, or do you reconfigure it? I have this theory that I love the science on your show. I have the theory that all of us are kind of rocks in a way, the igneous, the sedimentary, and the metamorphic. And I've always considered myself somewhat of a metamorphic rock, that under enough heat and pressure, I will change. I will flow. I will become something else. And I think that's key to surviving in Hollywood.
Well, it seems like it's key to happiness, right? If you can adjust the thing that will make you happy, then you'll be all right. You'll never be unhappy.
That's right. And it goes into what I guess you are anticipating. That's a key to happiness, too. If you're anticipating, if you're hoping for the wrong things to make you happy. I remember it was career day. Oh, heaven help us. High school career day. And I was asked to speak to a group of kids at Beverly Hills High School who wanted to be actors. And I was speaking with a wonderful man who sold real estate for his livelihood. But he is a very good actor. And he acted in some of the community productions there too. So he was speaking about how great acting was as a profession, which I thought was ironic in that that was not his profession. I got up to speak and said, how many of you in this room want to be actors because you want to be famous? All these hands shot up, you know, 70, 80 hands shot up. I said, how many of you are willing to be actors if you are never famous? If all you are able to do is community theater for no money, if you have to take on two jobs, make your own costume, to do a production which is never reviewed, and in fact, people never come to see it, how many of you then would still want to be an actor? And two girls over on the side raised their hands, and I said, you two are the only ones that are going to make it. It's what your expectations are. I think I'm going to name drop Kierkegaard. I think Kierkegaard said that expectations are the key to unhappiness, that when we have the wrong expectations, too high or wrong expectations, we imagine that we're unhappy, even though we could very easily be happy if we saw the world in a very real way.
Another thing that you had to face was going from being sort of a big star in, well, I know SMU is a little bit checkered for you, but in college and in graduate school, and then suddenly you're like dumped out into this ocean of people who were big stars in their college and their graduate school, and it's a different reality from knowing that you'll get the lead in every production.
Yeah, and it's different a little bit than in sports, too. I think the same thing happens in athletics. You have people who were always stars in the Pee Wee team and in junior high school, college. They were pitchers and baseball players of renown. And then, oh, here comes the major leagues. And it's a whole different thing. Yet there is some kind of criterion for an athlete. But for an artist, there is none. Because once you do a play, it's gone. Mm-hmm. It's vanished. No matter how good that performance was, it only lives in the memories of the people who saw it. A film is different because if you have a performance like a Ned performance or something that people enjoy, it's captured by film. But theater is gone. And when you're dumped into the world now with all sorts of people, in fact, I remember one of the auditions I had in Los Angeles, at the opening of the Los Angeles Theater Center, was for Chekhov's play, Three Sisters, mm-hmm. to play the role of Tuzenbach. And who walked into the room But the guy I auditioned against in college, he got the part of Tusenbach in college, and he walked into the room and he saw me in the final read-through. He goes, oh, so here we are again, you know, doing the old, you know, one-ups. Here we are again, Stephen. Good to see you. I said, yeah, here we are again. We're not in college anymore. You know, and it's the ocean is very big once you get out of school, and there are no life preservers.
I think what you do as, you know, people say character actor, and sometimes it gets distilled into this thing that is sort of like goofy bit parts here and there. And you write about the idea that, you know, if you're George Clooney, the entire film is going to explore your character, or the entire series if it's television. And every script kind of talks about your motivations and what your history is. When you're a character who has a few lines or is in a few scenes or one scene, you have to build that from scratch in order to make it convincing.
You have to ask the right questions. Yeah. George Clooney, Harrison Ford, these characters I mentioned in the book, any part in a script that has two names. In fact, sometimes they name the movie after the two names, you know, of the, but if you have Han Solo, Captain Jack Sparrow, all these guys have full names. When you play a lot of the parts I play, well, Ned Ryerson had a full name, Sandy Ryerson had a, Hugo Jari had a full name, but I've also played Ringmaster Bob. I've also played Father Ted, Father John, Father Joe. I've played, this is another thing I've noticed, too. When you're a character actor and you're in a comedy, they usually do your job description with your first name. Like like in Wild Hogs, I played Sheriff Charlie. Mm-hmm. That means it's a comedic character. If you are in a drama, they will take your character description with your last name, Father Donegan. With your last name, that means you're in a dramatic role. But you have to do all the work on your own. It's not provided for you by the writer. I remember, I don't think this is too much of a diversion, but I was playing a lawyer in a TV movie with Veronica Hamill, and I had one of these absolutely horrific, deadly scenes that comes on page 55. And for you people out there who don't know what page 55 is, you know what it is. In all TV movies, they have a deadly scene 55 minutes into the – it's a minute a page in a screenplay – 55 minutes in which the entire movie is recapped that you've seen thus far. The reason for this being is that network, when people are kind of shifting for channels, surfing – if they land on that right before it's time to change the hour, they'll hear what the whole movie is about and hopefully stay for the second hour. I had to have that scene where I recap the entire movie. Deadly dull. So as a lawyer, in the script it says lawyer 45. What does that mean? I don't know what lawyer means. I don't know what 45 means. Mm-hmm. I mean, am I a good lawyer, a bad lawyer? Am I the first lawyer in my family? Do I come from a long line of lawyers? All these questions matter, and you have to be able to ask them to be a character actor, or you will never have a real character. In this case, ooh, I hear the music. In this case, my guy was real, and I asked him if he was not a good lawyer, bad lawyer, but did he always want to be a lawyer? He said he always wanted to be a country western singer. Next day, I showed up with a guitar, and I made that scene on page 55 work.
My guest is writer and actor Stephen Tobolowsky. His new book is called The Dangerous Animals Club.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is actor and writer Stephen Tobolowsky. You may have seen, or rather heard, the radio series The Tobolowsky Files, which aired in 2011 and 2012. His new book, it's a memoir, is called The Dangerous Animals Club. You write, Stephen, about the secrecy that surrounds so much of entertainment media today because there's so many opportunities for people to get out there and ruin something, which for audition purposes, you get these things called sides, right, which are a couple of pages. How do you, I mean, sometimes you don't even know what the scene's about based on the lines you're given.
Right. You don't know at all. I remember there was one, we didn't even know what the movie was going to be. It turned out to be The Insider, directed by Michael Mann, mm-hmm. and I got a side that said clerk. Well, I had no idea what kind of clerk I was.
Store clerk, legal clerk.
Hotel clerk.
Yeah.
No idea. 7-Eleven. No idea. And you just have lines. And of course, if you take a look at the idea that the questions you ask as an actor to create a real person on the screen, there was nothing even to ask. I remember, boy, I wanted to be in this movie because Michael Mann is one of my favorite directors. He's just brilliant. The script was, well, I hadn't read the script yet. That was part of the issue. I don't want to get ahead of myself. I sat in the waiting room for about 2 hours thinking, how am I going to turn myself into a pretzel, to turn this clerk into something? I went in finally to see Michael. He said, well, shall we videotape this? Shall we put this down? And I said, no, let's not. It would just be a waste of time. And he looked at me kind of curiously, and I said, Michael, let me put it to you this way. As an actor, all I have is a point of view. When I have a side like this, I have no point. I have no view. If someone were to come up to you and say, Michael, we want you to direct a movie. It's going to be an action movie, but they don't tell you what period of time it's going to be in. They don't tell you what your budget is. They don't tell you who your stars are. What are you going to do? You're going to say, I have no point and I have no view. I don't know what an action movie means unless I know what the story is. That's where I am, Michael. I need to read a script before I play clerk. So he looked at me and gave me a contract to sign, a 4-page contract to sign, non-disclosure that they would murder and sue me at the same time if I revealed what was in the script. And I read the script, and it was brilliant. Mm-hmm. It was terrific. It had no title on it. I came back the next day, and I said, Michael, this was fantastic. Who wrote this script? And he said, well, I did, you know, with Peter Roth. And I go, I guess that was a good thing to say then. And I ended up in the movie, but I knew at that point who all the characters were, and it was a hotel clerk, by the way. I knew who all the characters were, and I could play any of the characters he asked me to play because I understood the characters, what they did, what their profession was, what they wanted. These were kind of the train cars on the track that helped me get there.
Do you still have to fight against the sense that actors are somehow interchangeable? That they're casting for your look and the sound of your voice. Not that those aren't important, but that what you bring to the role is sort of something that is taken for granted.
Oh yeah, completely. I remember I went in to HBO to audition for an HBO show, and I was sitting in the waiting room, and they looked at me and said, well, we already have a bald one. And I said, yeah, but do you have a tall one? Do you have a tall one with glasses? Yes, you do get the idea that you're completely interchangeable. And that's okay. That's okay. I've come to learn that in Hollywood, you don't have to be part of the solution. It's okay to just be part of the problem. I'm willing to be a stereotype. It's fine. It's better than not being anything at all, which is the option you have.
So this being a memoir, you explore your childhood, which was spent here in and around areas that people in our audience are in every day. Mm-hmm. You write about the fact that we don't get to choose our memories, that things stick in our heads for no particular reason. You also, though, share this story of something that you see as a miracle when your mother passed away a few years ago, that she was able to hang on until the whole family was there. And it occurred to me that we do choose our miracles.
Well, I think
The things we believe to
yes,
be miracles.
Yes, I think they're... I've been reading this weird philosophy, kind of religious thing, the Zohar. I don't know if your listeners know what the Zohar is.
I've heard of it, but I have not
read it. What the Zohar is, it was a medieval writing that was written about mysticism. And they take one line from the Bible or the Talmud or the Torah. They take one line and they look at it from all different sides to see what kind of mysteries are in that one sentence, which is pretty much what actors do anyway. Mm-hmm. And there was a line from Ezekiel that saying, Ezekiel saw what he saw and said what he said. And the people who are writing the Zohar said, why do they repeat the word saw what he saw? And say, and then you have all this commentary on what on earth that means. Now, you and I would listen to that and not think anything of it. He saw what he saw and he said what he said. But something in one of the commentaries, and this is from the Middle Ages, so this is probably from the 13th century. One of the things they said was, that is all we ever do, is we're limited by what we see, by what we choose to see. And we say we're limited by what we choose to say over what we have seen, that it's all a filter. It's all a matter of choice. And I think toward that, you are very right. In terms of putting the pieces together, what miracles do we see? What miracles are around us all the time? I remember I was injured very badly 5 years ago. I had a broken neck. And to recover, it took 3 months. And I thought, what am I going to do? I figured one of the things I could do was read. One of the things I could do was sit in the yard and watch the birds. And a little squirrel in the yard took issue with me and began throwing avocados and different things at my head. And it forced me further and further and further back into my yard. I used to call him Al-Qaeda squirrel. And you cannot negotiate with terrorists. So I just kept moving my bench further and further back in the yard. And while I'm very far back in the yard, I'm reading one of my books. And in my peripheral vision, I see flashes of purple and bright green. And I look up, and the back of my tree is covered with parrots, wild parrots. And my brain goes back 35 years to when I first came out to Los Angeles, and I heard the apocryphal story of a fire in a pet store in which the owner of the pet store was able to save the dogs and cats but not the birds. And he pulled the cages of his birds out and released them in the air. And the legend went, somewhere in Los Angeles, there was a flock of wild parrots still living from this fire. And I'm thinking the apocryphal was not only true, but they were living in my tree. They were right here. It was about that time I got the audition for Glee, mm-hmm. right? And so I get the script. I'm out there reading the script. And as I'm reading the script, a shadow crosses over the page. And I don't even look up because I know from the shape of the shadow, the shape of the wings and the speed of flight, I know it's one of my parrots flying back to my tree. And I think in my head, oh, well, that's the way it is with all miracles. It's easy to recognize the shadow once you've seen the real thing. And I stopped and I looked out into my yard, and my yard is filled with sunlight and shadows. And I thought, oh my gosh, what if just one of these shadows is not part of the darkness, but one of these shadows is a miracle unobserved, like those parrots were in my tree? And from that point on, I've adopted the point of view that you mentioned, is that we are surrounded by the miraculous all the time, and we're limited by our own vision of that he saw what he saw and he said what he said. We're limited by our own filters that we put on ourselves. So I do think we choose our miracles, and it's by our own limitation.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. My guest this hour is writer and actor Stephen Tobolowsky. His new book is called The Dangerous Animals Club. We should talk about that title because you write about the fact that, you know, you can be the super active parent and yet your kids are going to have this private secret life that, you know, all kids need to have. Yours involved like scouring the creeks and fields of Oak Cliff, which I guess when you were growing up was a little less populated than it is now, for animals that quite literally had the power to kill you.
Yes, yes. And the more deadly they were, the better it was. Billy Hart was a neighbor of mine, and I would kiss Mom on the cheek and say, I'm off to play, and sneak over to Billy Hart's house. He had a clubhouse, and we would go out down to Cripple Creek, and there were water moccasins and tarantulas and scorpions and centipedes, and we tried to capture these horrible things and bring them back to his clubhouse. And Mom had no idea what we were doing. It was deadly, deadly stuff we were doing. I look back at it now. It fills me with trepidation whenever any of my boys would go out and saying, well, Dad, I'm just going out to play. I'm like, oh, yeah, right.
Well, it's funny because you were young enough, you were old enough to know how to get this stuff, but young enough that when your neighbor said, oh, be careful, don't drop that snake, it'll follow you home, that I don't know whether he believed it or not, but you certainly believed it.
Oh, yeah, we totally believed that there was a code to nature. And not that we were violating it, but there was a code to nature, and if we followed those rules, we knew water moccasins, according to Billy Hart, who was, he was seven at the time, I think. I was six when we did this, so we weren't really at the top of our game yet. But, but Billy was saying that water moccasins, he knew for some reason, were smart and would be able to track me and follow me home. Now, since then, I've learned that water moccasins are enormously aggressive. And they do bear a grudge, and they're one of the snakes that will seek you out just because they're angry, you know. So there probably was some sort of truth in what Billy Hart said. some of the other things about tarantulas being stupid, I'm sure, and that they wouldn't follow us home when we tried to catch tarantulas, I'm sure that was probably true, too. I imagine the spiders are pretty stupid. but I think I named that story and the book, The Dangerous Animals Club, because a lot of times you don't know what story you're telling till you're at the end of the story. Mm-hmm. And I sort of recognize that a lot of my stories are about different kinds of dangerous animals. Some of them the two-legged variety, some of the variety you meet in show business, and some of the spiritual kind of animals we encounter, our own fears and things like that. So I wanted the book to be about the dangerous animals sort of we encounter in our life.
There was an interesting incident that you write about. You're happily married now, and you have two sons, but your first sort of life partner that you didn't marry was the playwright Beth Henley.
That's right.
And you write about sort of recognizing that the relationship would come to an end when you were playing cards and you caught her cheating on you and thought, okay, she's going to make a joke and it'll be funny. And you realized she didn't know that you knew. And it wasn't a joke. She just cheated.
Yeah, it was. We were playing Go Fish. We were in our little apartment on McFarland. We were playing Go Fish for no money. We were just sitting on the floor passing the time. And she wanted a Coke. So I went into the kitchen to get a Coke. And she didn't know that there was a framed picture in our kitchen that acted like a mirror.
So you could see her reflection.
I could see her reflection, and she, when I left to get it, she went through the deck to rearrange the deck to make sure that she would have to go fish and she would pick the card she needed and would win. And I just thought this was delightful because I thought, what kind of a joke is she going to play on me? And I got back and with her Coke, and we sat down and began to play, and she just won. She won, and she beat me at Go Fish for no reason at all. And I thought, oh my gosh. And it you try to wonder what are the little things that indicate that you're not going to stay together as a couple. Now, of course, at the time, I had no idea.
This was years before you broke up.
Yes, yeah. And it was a little thing. It was a trivial thing. But what wasn't trivial was my silence in not calling the issue forward, saying, Beth, I know what you did. I saw you. That's not a nice thing to do. I was silent and I was embarrassed. That's a major mistake that you make in a relationship, is you let something go by that should be spoken to and you let silence happen. And so later in our lives, when other egregious things would happen, I had developed the habit of never saying anything that bothered me. And you never go forward in a relationship that way. I mean, we had a lot of love and a lot of good times for a long time, but eventually silence will kill you.
Do you think that is the kind of detail that only an artist, a novelist would pick up on? Because reading it, I think we can all relate to why that story is so true, and yet I don't know that I've heard anyone else tell a story like that.
Yeah, I think probably it's true that it comes either from being a writer or an actor, because you end up looking for details, for clues on parts. I remember years before I was writing these stories, I ran into a woman who got divorced, and I asked her, how did you know? When did you know? And she says, oh, before we were married. And I said, how did you know you were going to get divorced before you were married? She said, the way my husband fixed coffee for me. I said, the way he fixed coffee for you? Yeah, he always put cream in it, and I always told him not to. And he kept putting cream in, and I realized he doesn't listen to me.
My guest is writer and actor Stephen Tobolowsky. His new memoir is called The Dangerous Animals Club.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is actor and writer Stephen Tobolowsky. His new memoir is called The Dangerous Animals Club. Let's go on the phone now to Ben in Fort Worth. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good, good. I was wanting to ask Stephen, what were his three favorite roles that he played and why? Not just the three longest running, but the three favorite that he really had a great time playing, and why did he enjoy those so much?
I think probably... certainly Ned Ryerson. That was a lot of fun. It was an exciting movie to be a part of because of the guerrilla filmmaking aspect of it, in that as we were shooting the film, about a third of the script was thrown away and was being rewritten as we were doing it. And so it was very exciting. Another one is Stu Beggs in Californication that I'm on now. I have rarely worked with such a good cast and such an easygoing cast. We have such terrific directors, and we're always laughing all the time on set. So certainly Californication was a terrific, terrific fun time. And here's a weird one. Here's a weird one. It was probably the greatest challenge I ever had. And I would say Sammy Jenkins in Memento. I had almost no lines, and I had to play someone who had amnesia. And when I met Chris Nolan, Chris was saying, well, Stephen, you know, there really aren't a lot of lines in this. I said, it's not the lines. I said, this is one of the most important parts in the movie. Everybody talks about Sammy Jenkins, and the scene where I kill my wife is brutal. It's an amazing scene in the movie. And it was so difficult to play a person with no memory. Because I recognized while we were shooting, that's the only thing that keeps an actor moving through a scene is remembering where he's going next. And if you take that out of the equation, you go nowhere. And it was terrifying, but I love the experience.
Do you have a method now, or maybe you've gotten used to letting go of the parts you really wanted and didn't get?
Yeah, different things. There are all sorts of disappointments in show business. And different things hurt different amounts of time, and you have no control over that. Some things that are little, that are inconsequential, end up hurting you a lifetime. And other things that you would think are monumental blows to your ego or to your pocketbook turn out to be easily forgotten. You can't trace how you will be affected by the disappointments. I think it is important. Again, there was a line in Shakespeare, nothing in Midsummer Night's Dream, nothing can be amiss when duty and simpleness tender it. And it's when the Duke is telling the players, it is the play that's the thing. If you focus on the story you're telling, nothing can be amiss. And as an actor, if you put the project you're working on first, the story you're telling first, and make that have life, then it doesn't matter what happens. That's as good as you can do. And win, lose, or draw, at least you've given it your best shot.
I was interested to read that you feel like your background in Shakespeare helped you get through Deadwood.
Oh, man, I don't know.
Because you don't, I mean, at first glance, you don't necessarily think of the dialogue matching up.
Either that or my penchant for masochism. Deadwood was certainly the hardest environment to shoot in. We shot in 100 degrees temperature. We shot in downpours, and it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. We wore the same suit of clothes we were issued the first day, you know, just like in prison, and they never washed them. So those clothes, by the middle of the season, were walking on their own. And a lot of people had profanity in Deadwood, a lot of profanity, more profanity than anyone could ever imagine. I did not. Mm-hmm. My lines were kind of inverted iambic pentameter, and I thought the only way I could approach this, and Powers Booth, a fellow SMU grad who was on that show, was saying, Tobo, we got to pull out the Shakespeare for this. That's the only way to get through it. I realized one of the reasons why the Deadwood lines were so difficult to learn is that often we talk in a line that has two sections to it. Hello, how are you? What's going on? I want to know what's happening. Something like that. Deadwood's lines were based in threes, which is very illogical for our brains to work on. You know, when I first came to South Dakota, this was long before the store here was built, I knew Indian Chief Bob. And there were all these clauses that seemed to be jammed into the sentences that never made any sense. So the only way to get through it, iambic pentameter. It'll get you through.
You mentioned earlier that, you know, the loss of certain roles is financially, you know, difficult. I wonder, I'm certain that for years you had to budget in a way that is not familiar to people who have like a steady job from year to year. And I wonder what you learned from that and whether there are things even now when I would imagine you're comfortable, patterns of managing things that reflect that time in your life.
You assume that I'm comfortable. I love that.
Well, I mean, no, you work a lot.
I work a lot, but my wife Ann and I, God bless her, we manage all the time. We are both grasshopper. Was it the grasshopper or the ant? Which one?
You're
was
the ant that I'm works hard, right?
Yeah. We're both the ants. Mm-hmm. We're two ants that live together. We both work hard, and we both manage. We never assume that if we have a windfall with one job, that means we're on easy street. Mm-hmm. It means like now we have to put this money aside because probably next week, next month, next year, we're going to have months with no income. This is probably the one thing that people who have regular jobs cannot imagine. And that is, in show business, when you're not working, you're not kind of working a little. You are not working. You have nothing coming in, and you have no idea when you're going to get a job. And the longer that period of time lasts, the more tense you get. So when you do get that audition, there's more riding on it, and it is more difficult for you to perform.
So it's not helpful to feel that desperation.
No. desperation, the casting directors can smell it on you. Mm-hmm. It's good just, again, if you focus on the part, if you focus on the story and not how much this audition means and how much this job will change your life, focus on the story and you'll be able to get through just about anything.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Madeline who says, I've been listening to the Tobolowsky Files on KERA, and the story about your son trying to hatch the duck egg, I guess this is with your mother, was priceless. And she says she almost drove off the road. She was laughing so hard. So we're glad Madeline made it home, but maybe you can share that story with us.
Yeah, I was working on a movie in Dallas, and I was thought, well, I would bring my son, who was 5 years old at the time, and mom would babysit for him. Mm-hmm. And the first day I was at the set, I came back, and mom had taken William to Turtle Creek. And she said, Stephen, we had the most beautiful day today. We saw turtles and ducks and geese, and we found an egg. And mom grabbed me by the sleeve and pulled me into the breakfast nook. And she had turned our little breakfast nook in our home into a makeshift hatchery. She had taken a table from the garage and a little basket, filled it with shreds of newspaper and cloth, took my dad's reading lamp, which he was not particularly happy about, to use it as heat. Mm-hmm. And we tried to hatch that egg. William told us that to make sure the egg hatched, we'd have to turn it every hour. And mom said she heard that was true. So there are my two ornithologists, my mother and my five-year-old son. So we spent the rest of that week turning the egg. Then the egg came back with us to California, in which my wife had to take over. Annie had to take over. She got a basket. She got my son's reading lamp. We turned the egg every hour. William lectured us on the dangers of the human smell, that when the baby was born, we had to keep away from the baby. Otherwise, no other bird would come near it the rest of its life. We ended up turning that egg for 5 weeks, and I don't know if I want to be a spoiler and tell what happened once that egg hatched.
Well, we can leave it. It is a very funny story, and suffice it to say, it was a surprise.
It was a surprise what was inside the egg. That is for sure. But it was, I don't want to spoil too much. But it is, I guess, you know, it was on KERA. The story's on KER, and my understanding is it's still streaming live, so people can listen to that story. I think if they click on KERA, you're able to listen to it.
How do you decide when you are still in midlife, you're telling the story of your life thus far, what goes in and what stays out and what's too personal and what's personal but in the service of honesty needs to be there anyway?
Yeah. Honesty. Yeah, honesty and truth are two different things. My dear friend Bob told me that honesty is a bludgeon you could hit people over the head with. Honesty is basically what's true, but from your point of view. But when you hear the truth, it changes your life forever. What I try to do in my stories is I want to tell stories that are true. And from my point of view, because I feel true always trumps clever, I let myself write. And I don't censor myself while I'm writing, and sometimes the events in the story will inform me as to what the story is. And that helps me with the editorial process about this should be here, this should not be here. In terms of censoring things that need to be there in terms of truth, do they? In olden times, in biblical times, the crime right beneath murder was the murder of a reputation. Now, I know that's very unfamiliar in our day and age when the murder of a reputation is show business. It's entertainment.
It's reality TV.
It's entertainment. It's what happens 24/7 on television. But to me, I ask myself, if this were to be heard by that person, true or not, would it hurt them? And I try to be very careful as to what I put in the story, not just to use any old thing that's true or not for sensational details. I don't think that's necessary. And so far I haven't found it necessary. But I don't think it's limited me so far in telling very revealing stories. So it's an ongoing experiment. We'll see what happens in book two.
Is there a book two?
There is a book two. Simon & Schuster, they were thrilled with Dangerous Animals Club, and I'm happy to say they asked me to write a second book, so I am in the midst of that now.
I want to talk about the traveling that you do, because I think when people think, if there's anything glamorous about show business, the idea of shooting on location sounds fantastic, and your passport has stamps from all over the world, honestly, you don't make it sound that enviable.
Well, sometimes it is. Like when I went to Thailand, it was amazing. We stayed at a 4-star hotel, or 5-star, 6, however many stars you have. We were in that hotel. You come into the hotel, and a man says to me, "You've been traveling so long today. Just have a seat. I'll check in for you. I will take care of your luggage. I'll get you a drink. Would you like a Mai Tai? Please, sit here. We'll take care of everything." You get to the hotel room. A woman in full Thai dress throws gardenia petals across your bed and then washes your hands and feet in rose water and hands you the TV changer. How good is that? But then you can contrast that with a film I did, Love, Liza, in Alabama, in which the motel, the Lamplighter was the name of the motel, and I don't think this harms their reputation because it was public, they advertised heated hallways. You know, I've never been to a hotel that advertised heated hallways. They had no restaurant. It was locked up and bolted, chained with chairs and tables going up. So if I wanted anything to eat, I had to run across the 6 lanes of interstate, dodging cars to go to the deli on the other side. So it's a crapshoot. It depends where you shoot as to the kind of luxury you have. For some reason, because of my accent and my Texas upbringing, I tend to shoot in the South, where the Lamplighter has been more in my future than the Thai experience.
Well, may you be back in Thailand soon.
You may I.
Stephen Tobolowsky's new book is called The Dangerous Animals Club. Stephen, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell does our podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.